Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, if you're planting a vegetable garden this summer, why not go a step further and make it organic for your own health and the health of the planet? We'll talk with a gardening expert about what makes a garden organic, along with what you'll need and other helpful tips.
But first, you caught an item on the news about toxic chemicals on cash register receipts, the same ones found in plastic bottles. All day at work, you can't stop thinking about it. And over your double cheeseburger lunch with extra large fries, you scour the internet for more information. As you step outside for a quick smoke break, you wonder how many receipts you've touched this week and if they'll lead to cancer. Now, what's wrong with this picture? Bad eating habits, tobacco consumption, and you're worried about dying from register receipts?
This gap in perception illustrates how often we view risk through a distorted lens. We know fast food and smoking are bad for us, yet we focus on other perceived threats to our health and well-being. Our next guest is an expert on risk perception and risk communication. David Ropeek has taught this subject at the Harvard School of Public Health and has written about it for the New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, and Nova. He's the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Hi, David. Thanks for joining us on Take Care.
Glad to be with you.
The title of your book, How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts, alludes to the gap in perception between what we think and feel is risky and its actual potential to harm us. Explain how and why this gap exists.
Well, it's a fallacy for humans to presume that we can be purely objective about anything. In fact, cognition is a combination of what information we have, which is usually never all of it, and the need to quickly turn that into sense, make sense of it, including make sense of it in terms of what might be threatening. So we have very powerful subconscious cognitive tools. When I say cognitive, it's we're not thinking about it consciously, that the brain uses to turn partial information into how it feels and what to do about it on the fly. And they're largely instinctive, emotional. They can't be fully fact-based. So with perception of anything, like my voice for your listeners right now, they're interpreting it through these emotional filters. This is particularly strong when it comes to staying alive, because your brain's job when it gets up in the morning is to get you to bed. That's the first job. The rest of it is, you know, making sense of things smartly or getting good grades and winning Nobel Prizes. The first job is survival. So it really throws every instinct and emotion it can quickly at information to sense whether it might be dangerous or not. And stuff like the chemicals that you just talked about versus eating that nice meaty cheeseburger all have kind of emotional characteristics that make some instinctively feel scarier than others.
So we often think, oh, there is the practical, evaluating, fact-based mind, and there is the emotional, feeling mind. But you're saying that really it's not one or the other. It is a blend.
Right. The default mind is the lazy mind, if you will, the one that doesn't like to have to spend a lot of extra calories, because when our brain was evolving, it learned to do these tricks when it wasn't sure the next 7-Eleven was down the street. And the brain is way more hungry for calories than any other part of our body. A quarter of our calories per day are used by just the brain. So it defaults to using instincts and emotions rather than having to pay attention, concentrate. It makes my head hurt to think. That's calorically expensive. So the brain defaults to these instincts pretty quickly. And as a result, we sometimes make mistakes about what to worry about.
So the world we live in now is a complicated one. And I think there might be more to it than back in the day when we just had to avoid getting killed by a bigger animal than ourselves or scavenge for food. And the question is, with all the information that's out there now, how are we adapting to these risks and how we're perceiving these risks? It almost seems like you're saying there's an intuitive part, a feeling part, and I think it probably would be beneficial if more of the thinking part helped us assess what is really risky and what can be ignored to some degree. And your book really deals with that and the whole process of it. But there are things that are going on in society today. And just taking this It sounds superficial and like it wouldn't play a big role, but let's say the 24/7 news cycle and the media exaggerating, or at least let's say repeating over and over and over something, a horrible tragedy, or salmonella poisoning somewhere in the United States, or how many people are dying from the flu. And you hear this enough and see it enough that it's exaggerated. And I think that is an example of it's hard to keep things in perspective. So what is your reaction to the role that the media play in what we perceive as risk?
Lots of really interesting points that you've made in there. So let's deal with the media one first. The study of the psychology of risk perception by Paul Slovic and Baruch Fischoff, the smarter people than me who have figured this stuff out, and I brought it together in my book as a journalist, have found that one of the instinctive ways that the brain makes sense of things and makes its decisions on the fly is called the availability heuristic. Heuristic is a fancy word for a mental shortcut. Basically, what it means is what's on our radar screen screams louder. A 24/7 radar screen that's focused on Malaysia Air 370 or cash register receipts or terrorism or Putin in Crimea or whatever, the fact that we're surviving longer than ever before as humans isn't on the radar screen. The scary stuff is. And I was a TV reporter for 22 years, and I did this. Journalists, news media folks, want attention for their work. The bosses want to sell the work. The reporter wants to be on page one. The same thing happens. What feels scary to us, you and me, feels like it will probably get our attention to a journalist and is identified as that's what we're going to play. That's the story we're going to run. So they run it up the flagpole. In fact, a media analyst named George Gerbner, he's passed away now from the University of Pennsylvania, called the phenomenon that we're discussing here the mean world syndrome, in which he posited, and he was talking about entertainment, but it's true of news too. If that's the world that gets painted, and that's all you know, because like Walter Cronkite used to say, that's the way it is, what else do you know about what's going on in Crimea or Malaysia Air, right? If that's all you know and it's painted as a scary world, you end up running around like Chicken Little thinking the sky's falling. There's one other point, though, I want to add that gets to the first part of your question. We are more instinctive and emotional risk perceivers than cognitive, rational, objective, just the facts, ma'am, thinkers. That was easier to use to survive when it was lions and tigers and bears in the dark, like you said. But the issues in a modern, global, complicated, technological world are climate change and industrial technologies like biotechnology and nanotechnology and climate change, my gosh. And they call for more cognitive, careful, objective analysis, but our brain is not built for that. And it means that the problems are getting more complex against a risk perception system that is less and less up to that sort of challenge.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Raff.
And we're talking with risk perception and risk communication expert David Ropeek. He has taught this subject at the Harvard School of Public Health and has written about it for the New York Times. And he is the author of the book, How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Okay, David, you mentioned the whole idea of how we're not really effective at processing the more factual information. And one of the questions that I often wonder is, why is it that we aren't so good at assessing level of risk? For example, we mentioned at the top the cash register receipts and the plastic bottles. The chemical is BPA. Many of us have talked about it. But we just see it as it's present, it's not present. We don't think about how many parts per million or whatever. In other words, there are degrees of risk. The BPA on cash register receipts is minuscule. And yet, you know, as we mentioned in the top, the idea of eating a cheeseburger, we know that's laden with cholesterol and bad things, but we are on off about it. Cheeseburger doesn't matter. That's off. BPA present in cash register receipts, that's on. Why are we so absolute in our assessment of risk?
Yeah, so let's talk about the specific emotional characteristics using those two examples that are just some examples in my book of the psychology of why some things feel scarier than they actually are, and some things feel less scary than they actually are. The hamburger, let's take the cheeseburger. Tastes good, right?
Yes, it certainly does.
Yeah, my mouth's watering right now. So that's a benefit. And whenever there's an activity of any kind, bungee jumping, for God's sake, for people who like the thrill, you play down the risk. Mentally, you do that so that you get to do what you want to do in life. Speed, text, or use your cell phone when you drive, go out into the sun without sunscreen because it's all oily, a long list of things that we do because we wanna, And when we wanna, we play down the scary side. There's another part of the do part. We choose to eat the hamburger. We don't choose to have some chemical company put a chemical on a cash register receipt. And the very act of engaging in the behavior voluntarily means it's less scary. Imagine you're driving your car and using your cell phone and talking, and let's say you're holding your phone. I don't know what's legal in New York. But you look over and there's somebody driving poorly next to you because they're on their phone, and that is what makes you angry. Wait a minute, you're doing the same thing. The other guy makes you angry, and you say, wow, we ought to ban cell phones. Well, you're not saying ban mine. You're saying ban his. Because an imposed risk, just because it's imposed, feels bad. Well, that's industrial chemicals. That's genetically modified food. They feel like somebody else is doing it to us. There's another factor. Chemicals is a class. Of course, we're made of chemicals, so it's kind of nonsense to say chemicals. It means industrial chemicals. But effectively, if you ask people what's the first thing that comes to mind when you say the word chemicals, lots of bad comes out. Not good. There's both. There's both. There's bad, for sure. But it's a stigmatized class, and the brain uses something called representativeness bias, which means that when you hear a word and you don't have all the facts about bisphenol A, and am I exposed through my skin or my stomach or my air, and what are the parts per million, but you want to judge whether it's dangerous, you open up the filing cabinets of what you already know to see what the clue represents. And chemicals is a filing cabinet full of scary. So those are just three of many, many factors. Here's another very quick one with industrial chemicals. We eat chemicals all the time when we eat an apple. We eat chemicals all the time when we eat a banana or an orange or a kale, or, you know, our vegan diets are full of chemicals, my gosh. But they're natural chemicals. We don't think of them as chemicals because human-made risks scare us more than natural ones. So we regulate the bejesus out of pharmaceuticals, biologically active substances we take to change our health, and barely regulate at all natural remedies, which are biologically active substances we take to modify our health, some of which have side effects, because the natural ones don't scare us. So there are lots of these characteristics that lead to these perceptions.
Well, that's a perfect segue for what I wanted to talk to you about next. Take Care is a health and wellness show, and I know you've investigated and talked about these issues. And one of the pieces you wrote is about how we have this trust of medicines and supplements that are labeled natural, but we have a distrust of anything human-made, as you're pointing out, with chemicals. Explain what you discovered. What is it about the term natural that is so warm and fuzzy to so many people?
There's lots of psychology to suggest that we have an affinity to nature. Nature is good. Of course, nature is good and bad. It's all of the above, right? But we like lakes and zoos and open space and parks and hiking and all this stuff. And so there's a whole theory that Edward Wilson came up with called biophilia. Bio, the biological world, philia, are attracted to, that we have a powerful affinity to nature. That's one potential reason. The other potential reason, at least the actual researchers who've done this work, that's not me. I'm a journalist who summarized it all in my book. Posit is, we can't blame God or the spirits or the energy source or whatever kind of larger thing that you choose to believe in, even just the natural physical order of physics, if you will, if you're a devout atheist, for rain. But we can blame nuclear power plants for going wrong and fouling our air and water. So human-made things have a component of somebody out there who ought to have done better did this to me. Well, you can't blame God, if you're, you know, God believer, for the sun coming out and giving you skin cancer. So that's an underlying psychology, too, that makes natural versus human-made different. Further, the human-made risks that we're particularly afraid of, and you mentioned BPA, bisphenol A, so I'll use that as another example, are often surrogates, targets for advocates who have a worldview about, for example, big evil companies having too much power and wealth, Monsanto, or being selfish and profiting at our risky expense. We don't like any risk when it's not fair, when somebody else gets the benefit and we take the risk. Some people don't like modern agriculture, too big, too commercial, too many people living on the planet. Genetically modified food is going to help that. So they target individual representations. The chemical industry and its products. BPA is the current example, but we've gone through several in the past, and there'll be more in the future. Genetically modified food technology, heck, there are lots of applications that are both safe and really beneficial for people's health. But they all get swept into this wow, that's a good target so that we can attack the larger thing that our values are about. And modern environmentalism has a lot of really wonderful, strong values, and I share many of them, but they tend to attack things that seem to be attacked one at a time, but are really representation surrogates of what their worldview values are about. And this natural versus man-made is a classic category for that one.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and there's so much to talk about, but I do want to cover one thing before we say goodbye, and that is for those of us who do research, when we don't want to take our gut feeling, we want to get the facts about something new or something that we've read or heard about, get the facts so we can correctly assess what risk is this to us. But it's been tricky lately, and probably for a while, in that how do you trust what's on the internet? We want facts, but whose facts? Who's spinning those facts? In the minute or so we have left, what is your advice to the general public who want to get the facts before they make a decision on what is healthy for them?
First of all, your advice is spot on. So we have all these emotional things that get in the way of making an objective choice because the brain is lazy and goes to that first. Stop. Work. Do a little fact-finding. That will help you make healthier choices. Simple, but you have to make the effort. Second, when you're searching for sources, be skeptical about the point of view of any source that you're looking at, including the ones that seem to say the things that you like. So even if you're against genetically modified food, if you're on Greenpeace's website, are they going to be giving you the straight story? Well, if you want to make a healthy choice, you owe it to yourself to question the advocacy, the point of view, the bias of any source on the net. Now, that's hard because we like affirmation more than information sometimes, and the internet is really poisonous with that. You can get affirmation of whatever you choose to believe. But the goal here is if you want to make a healthier choice about bisphenol A or genetically modified food or terrorism or crime or whatever, get more information, pause, don't make a knee-jerk reaction, and be suspicious of the agendas of any source, like a good reporter would be, so that you can have your BS antenna up a little bit as you read anything you read.
David Ropeek is the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Thanks so much for joining us on Take Care.
Stay safe. Glad to share.
For more information on David Ropeek and his book, How Risky Is It Really? Visit the Take Care webpage at WRVO.org. If you've missed a past interview or you'd like to hear one again, podcasts of our show are also available at our website and on iTunes.
Coming up, you'd buy organic fruits and vegetables at the supermarket if they weren't so expensive. Why not try your hand at organic gardening this summer? Advice for beginners from a top gardening expert. You're listening to Take Care on WRVO Public Media.